May Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California. It's September the 19th, 1977. I jotted down dialogue conspiracy number 286, but I think it's 287. I keep track each week, but I forgot to write it down. I believe it's number 287 for those of you that keep your reels or cassettes numbered. I'm going to talk about a book today that I've had a while called We Never Went to the Moon by Bill Kasing and Randy Reed. It's called America's $30 Billion Swindle. It's a fascinating book, and the reason I'm going to discuss it with you today is that because there was a large article in the Associated Press this Sunday on Sputnik Revisited, the opening of the space age, and there's some hints in this article on the necessity of our having the moonshot at the time we did, and it's important to read this book because there's so many conspiracies and unanswered questions going on that we have to challenge some of the news media and keep our eyes open. I saw a quotation recently by Albert Gorky. It went like this. Research is to see what everybody else has seen and to think what nobody else has thought. I think that's important for Bill Kasing's case in studying the moonshot, and I want to talk about it. I think it's true of the work that I've done on Son of Sam and these other zombies that have been controlled by hypnosis and government drugs. And we'll also go into the possibility that the astronauts were controlled by the government psychological department. I do have an article this week in Midnight. I meant to announce it last week because they go off the stands tomorrow here in Carmel. It's the September 20th issue, if you can still get it. It's called Scandal of the CIA's Secret LSD Test. And there's pictures of Jack Ruby and David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam, Sirhan Sirhan, and Gary Gilmore. A lot of people have speculated that Sirhan was programmed to forget what he was doing in the Ambassador Hotel or why he would take shots at people in the room. And there's been talk about Jack Ruby being hypnotically controlled, having contacts he actually did with hypnotists right up to the time when they shot Lee Harvey Oswald. This is the first account that's been published anywhere in the world of a Son of Sam or Gary Gilmore being under the control of government tests. I did mention that several times on Dialogue Conspiracy, but it's in print this week in Midnight, and you can pick that up. It also is the first time that has ever been printed, the list of the colleges and institutions by name, some of them funded by the CIA. They have the list of the universities and the hospitals where $26 million was funded. I have at home the list of what projects went to these particular places. But the David Berkowitz story is the most current of those stories, so it's the easiest to follow. Before I get to the moon story, I might mention I received a call from New York just about a half hour before I came to KLRB from Grant Dewey. He's a very close friend in New York City who has sent me many, many invaluable articles, and he's kept me up to date along with one other party. I don't know if they want me to mention their name on the air. About the Son of Sam case, and he sends me clippings from the New York papers and keeps me up right from the beginning. He was suspicious that this was a programmed government zombie. And as a matter of fact, Grant had called a woman by the name of Molly Friedman, whose name was in the New York Post, who's a handwriting expert. She wasn't listed in the telephone book, and he tried to find her office and address, and it was a dummy front. He finally located her and challenged her today on the telephone and recorded it on the evidence in the Son of Sam case. The latest news I heard was that there was a letter mailed out of the prison to a Mr. Dunleavy of the Washington Post. And David Berkowitz is claiming that the Son of Sam, the man that programmed him, also programmed Mr. Fred Cowan, the Nazi that did the mass shooting upstate New York, New Rochelle, where Sam had lived, not far from where he lived at the time he was doing these other killings. Fred Cowan was a proclaimed Nazi and gunned down several blacks. And you remember this case, as I say, it was just a short while ago. And Sam claims that they were both programmed by the same person and that in his apartment when he was arrested were facts and information about Mr. Cowan. Mr. David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam, is now in the control of the psychiatrist, and it's scandalous. The New York police can't question him at all. The evidence of the handwriting is coming to the attention of researchers and people that are concerned citizens, such as Grant in New York. And the question now is who did the writing, because one letter was sent to Jimmy Breslin in New York, the newspaper writer, with a very nice script, a handwriting script. And then when David Berkowitz was arrested, he was writing in a regular handwriting. It wasn't printed. And they don't seem to be matching, and now he has been able to get, I think, one letter out, as I say, to the Post, asking for some kind of help. And he's totally isolated in his little psychiatric cell and can't reach the outside world. He hinted in this one letter that he knew about files on disasters and earthquakes, and evidently he needs some help. So the David Berkowitz case is being investigated by some very good people in the East Coast who are keeping up with it and with the control the psychiatrists have over him. And I hope that this story will be unfolding as more people become aware of the patterns of the conspiracies they could take Son of Sam or Gary Gilmore, and the program Patsy Syndrome would go right back to the same kind of script that was done in the political assassinations in terms of their mobility and who was contacting these people and the wall of secrecy, the news media being silent and the patsies locked up and the psychological profiles and the writings on the wall or the diaries, the incriminating evidence or the source of weapons for all the assassinations or conspiracies will eventually be traced back to the same sources, which is the intelligence community in this country. I will most of the time now be talking about that moonshot. In fact, it may take 2 weeks because there's so much material, and I may decide to just give you the title of the book. If you want to order it and continue it, you can continue your own research. The book on the moon, Bill Kasing, has a page further along the book, which is enclosed, but I want to begin describing the book in this way. He says, special note, in the film Diamonds Are Forever, with Sean Connery playing the role of Agent 007, James Bond, there's a curious and unexplained scene. He enters a secret research facility in the Nevada desert by ruse. Suddenly, he finds himself in a large room in which there is an authentic moon landscape. Lumbering around in their clumsy spacesuits are two would-be astronauts. Nothing happens, the scene is not explained, and the viewer is left to ponder the significance. Could it be? Mr. Kasing asks. He answers it. Yes, it could, because he maintains that the moonshot never went off and the government had the necessity, the political necessity, for fooling all of us in order to save face because the Soviet Union had set up Sputnik. Mr. Kasing also has a section in Chapter 10 where the astronauts Manchurian candidates, and that is important because, again, in every subject that I go into in the assassinations and conspiracies is the use of hypnosis or drugs or programming, whether it's electrodes, but some kind of mind manipulation. And I think of, I'll read you some of Chapter 10, but I think of a new movie that just came out by Werner Herzog that has been described in the New York Times September the 11th, 1977, if you want to go to the library and get it. It's a new movie, and everyone in the cast was hypnotized in order to make the movie. And there's a really gross picture of one of the actors in the process of being hypnotized. A picture of him, it said, having hypnotized one of his actors, Werner Herzog is ready to shoot the movie called Hearts of Glass. It's opening this next week in the New York Film Festival. Werner Herzog is one of the young men who lived in the Germany at the time, right after the Reconstruction of the war. He's in his 30s at the time that a lot of people were fingering Adolf Hitler as being the sole guilty one and not understanding the true breadth of fascism in Europe. And Mr. Herzog is quoted in the New York Times. He says, there's no way to meet Hitler. He's dead. But if you approach a phenomenon like Hitler with prefabricated hatred, your vision will be blurred. Don't speak of Hitler. There's too much resentment, and it's too much to ask a German to defend Hitler, particularly the young ones. Let's speak of Son of Sam. He's called a mad dog. He's not a mad dog. He may be a mad human being, but he compared Hitler to the Son of Sam. What's going on now? He said, you have to acknowledge that human beings have dignity and they have madness. And when they start to kill each other, they may act like dogs, but they're not. They're humans. As a German, he said, I'm apprehensive today about your insecticide commercials. I know for sure there's only one step from insecticide to genocide. The lethal gas at Auschwitz was represented as insecticide. Hitler's heritage to German youth today makes us hypersensitive to these things, and that's why I ask for some sympathy and legitimacy. But the point of the Herzog movie, as I say, The Heart of Glass, is that the actors are all hypnotized. I will now jump to a section of the book that is titled We Never Went to the Moon. Chapter 10, Worthy Astronauts, Manchurian Candidates. Colonel Aldrin, one of the astronauts, wrote a book when he came home called Return to the Earth. Following his return to the Earth, Buzz Aldrin experienced an increasingly severe mental illness. Here are a sample of quotations from his book, The Return to the Earth, page 22. This kind of tension that I felt simmered for the next few weeks, but it never has been able to surface. Page 25, where we were to become public relations men for space exploration, in a sense, merely salesmen. The word made me terribly uncomfortable and self-conscious when it was first used. Page 68, what a surprise. The people who lined streets were exceedingly polite, but not at all enthusiastic. He was talking about in Sweden, where there was question then abroad about whether the moonshot was real. Page 68, I felt all six of us were fakes and fools for allowing ourselves to be convinced by some strange concept of duty to be sent on the mission. Page 288, my intellect was not separated by the jagged and dangerous wall of my emotions. The rule of my emotions was absolute and ruthless. I yearned for a brightly lit oblivion, and I wept for it. Page 295, should anyone discover that I was in the hospital for nervous problems, the explanation was going to be that I was treated for a neck problem. The other problem, if at all possible, was to be kept secret. The other problem. Page 304, the last 2 years of my life, from the time I left the lunar quarantine quarters until I entered Wilford Hall, the mental hospital, were characterized by depression, which deepened, temporary optimism, and then I'd sink a new low. My life is unreal. It was incredulous. She had really believed, he's talking about his wife, all that crap she read about me, about her and about all of us. Suddenly, all my life was tingled with a crazy unreality. Page 388, when I began this book, I had two intentions. I wanted it to be as honest as possible. And Mr. Kasing has asked, why not just plain honest? In June 1971, Aldrin went back to the Air Force, and he was assigned to Edwards Air Force Base in California. He was on medication for nervous disorder. He got Ritalin pills once a day. And this is the quotation of 1971, when he was supposed to give a speech out at Edwards Air Force Base. I looked great. There was only one problem. I believe my confidence to be rooted in reality. Early in June, an event was scheduled that we regarded as a new beginning for us, and we looked forward to it. I wanted to be my very best. The occasion was a big meeting at Lancaster Chamber of Commerce. They invited members of the Society of Test Pilots, and I was supposed to be the guest speaker. What intrigued me most was that I couldn't give a speech. Instead, Roy Neal, the NBC newscaster, would interview me. He wanted to interview me in an informal way. The afternoon of the banquet, I went to Roy's motel and said, do you want to go over any questions with me? And he said they would be easy to answer and there'd be no preparations. That wasn't necessary. As banquets go, it was a large one. The base commander, General and Mrs. White, were there. I was more apprehensive as time go on. The first question that Roy Neal asked me was, now that 2 years have gone by, why not tell how it really felt to be on the moon? Now, if there was any one question that was anathema to me, that was it. Roy, I suppose, felt he had no choice, yet it had always been impossible for me to answer that question with any decent response. My throat went dry. I became dizzy. I picked my way through with a carefully picked my way through with a reply, thinking that all the test pilots in the audience were then going to burst out with laughter. I remember little more of that interview, he wrote. When it was over, I stepped down and stood before the Chamber of Commerce, where wives were waiting for autographs. I signed a few. I began to shake uncontrollably. I grabbed Joan and ran for the door. In the privacy of an alley near the auditorium, I choked my emotions. I wept. When I composed myself, I was inconsolable. I judged myself too harshly, and I got drunk. And Mr. Kasing goes on to say, in Hamlet, the hero plans to trap the supposed murderer of his father by staging a play. The play is the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. And later he says, if he but blench, I'll know my course. And then Mr. Aldrin went on to say that he got very sick and began to have a nervous collapse. And he had to live with this lie. He didn't say it in a lie. He said, I discussed the Aldrin incident with the parallel to Shakespeare's play with a specialist in human communication. And he said that probably Aldrin's hypnotic state, imposed as part of the moon trip simulation, was finally terminated by that one critical question asked at the crucial time. If he but blench, knowing he had to lie, and a West Point graduate almost never lies, he went through what triggered a severe nervous collapse over a question such as that. Well, what was the time span of the history of Sputnik? When did it go up? Many of you don't remember it. And briefly, I'll review some of it before we get into the facts of the moonshot that are so carefully and interestingly put into this book. And you can write to me. I'll give you the address on the air if you want to be getting a pencil and order this book. I'm reading from the San Francisco Examiner, September 18th, just last Sunday. Sputnik went up 20 years ago next month at 7:30 p.m., October the 4th, 1957. You could say the evolution of a man, that man was no longer a prisoner of his planet. 20 years ago in 1957, and you have to remember the chronological history now of America, that 57 was an important year where I said Howard Hughes was drugged and Candy Jones described how she was drugged and controlled. Many famous people, Elvis Presley was in Hollywood getting his personality altered. It was in October 1957 that many, many historic and valuable events for future writers were taking place and many lives were being affected. This Associated Press story says it was a triumph for one nation. It was a humiliation for another. At the moment, it was perceived in terms of nationalism, of shifting the equations of the Cold War. Nikita Khrushchev was euphoric about a 22-inch ball. Just stretch your hands. That isn't very much. A 22-inch ball called Sputnik, and it began to orbit the Earth. People of the whole world are pointing to the satellite, and they are saying the U.S. has been beaten. This is a quotation of Khrushchev. The godless, technological, backward Russians were up there first. The age of space belonged to them. Now, 20 years later, the Americans can say they went to the moon, and the Associated Press goes on to say the pride that America had sent their men to the moon. In two decades of traumas, of self-doubt, of self-questioning that started with Sputnik, there followed the U-2 shot, the Bay of Pigs, the multiple assassinations in America, the race riots, the Vietnam problems with the campus explosions, Watergate, dirty laundry of the presidents. And now Jimmy Carter can proclaim when he sends up a spacecraft out to space with a capsule of 60 Earth languages, we human beings, he said by way of introduction, are still divided into nation states, but these are rapidly becoming a single global civilization. That ought to thrill the Rockefeller, people that hate Rockefeller, who fear the Council of Foreign Relations, and the Bilderbergers, and the people that are afraid of a one-world society. Jimmy Carter was saying it when he just launched this latest space capsule. But the article goes on that it's the 20th anniversary of the space age, which had a profound consequence, and it revolved around a single photograph. And this is important because the book goes into the simulation of the photograph. That picture of the place the spacemen left and the blue and white sphere alone, this picture of the Earth taken from the moon, this single vision would prove to the world about our great space feat. Mike Collins came back from the moon in 1969, and he remembered the view 100,000 miles from his home, and he looked out of there, and he wondered why people make such a fuss over borders, what's so important. about infighting. Why don't we get along with each other? This was the feeling he had. And yet the article goes on to say that no country, nobody has scurried from space with this armament. It hasn't worked one peace movement. And yet we've become more involved in weapon systems since we allegedly sent these men to the moon. Sputnik was an important part of the Cold War, this article says, because after VE Day and VJ Day, America felt that they were the greatest. We were number one. But Sputnik knocked that out of them. Sputnik did much to us. And then a flood of federal dollars went into education, into government training programs, into the sciences, into the math. An explosion of money went to scientific and technological research and research for national purpose. The article also includes the quotation of Dwight Eisenhower about warning about the military-industrial complex, because after Sputnik had gone up, a large amount of money, billions and billions and billions of dollars, went into the space program, which Mr. Kasing says are military dollars. They're not peace dollars. It was never set up for peace purposes. It was a military operation. Now, the moonshot took place in July of 1969, that great moonshot. And many of you may remember, or you may not remember, that that was the night that Ted Kennedy had the accident in Chappaquiddick. Now, if you can accept some of the facts in this book that I'm going to be sharing with you, you have to have a view of history, an overall view of what was happening in July 1969. Richard Nixon had been selected to be president of the United States early in his career by Howard Hughes, the aerospace industry, Lockheed, and the makers of the rockets and the satellites, the weapons of war that would be utilized in the space project. Richard Nixon's presidency had been hampered by Senator Robert Kennedy's nomination. Robert Kennedy was killed by a guard from Lockheed, the same Lockheed that had put Richard Nixon into office, along with 100 top corporations and people when he first ran for Congress in 1946. The makers of the U-2 airplane also had a guard named Thane Caesar, who shot Robert Kennedy in the back of the head, 1 inch from the back of the head, the fatal shot. And that allowed Richard Nixon to become president in 1968. By 1969, there was one more Kennedy to go. Many of you might have seen that movie this week on Joe Kennedy. If not, you can get the book on the killing of Joe Kennedy. There's a book out on that subject. John Kennedy was dead and Robert Kennedy was dead. And there was one more Kennedy left to run for president, and that was Ted. In 1969, in June 69, Herbert Kalmbach, a bag man, money man for Richard Nixon and the Dirty Tricks, gave Tony Laskowitz $100,000. Tony Laskowitz was the agent who had the call houses with the two-way mirrors, the CIA houses for blackmail. And Tony Laskowitz was on the island of Chappaquiddick the night the Mary Jo Capecchi was murdered. Now, that wasn't just a one simple death of a woman who had blood on her blouse with all the usual mysteries of all the other assassinations and conspiracies. But this single event was done to remove a man who had a very good chance of becoming president of the United States. And the selection of that event had to be scaled to a place where they knew that he went annually, such as the regatta, the sailing in New England. If the timing of Ted Kennedy's annual visit to Johannesport in 69 could be pinpointed, or any other single place where they knew that he went every year, and if the moonshot was simulated to happen at the same time the cloud won off the newspapers, which it certainly did, the moonshot could come at any night out of 365 nights in the year. There wouldn't be any particular day or reason. And I've always felt that the Chappaquiddick and the moonshot were linked. And as I read more and more, which I continuously do, on the accident of Chappaquiddick, and then you study the evidence on the moonshot, and if both were conspiracies and were handled by integral parts of a larger plan where the operators have the same names and are working together through the various assassinations as well as in the NASA moon product, it's not difficult to believe that they were chosen at this particular night to cover the news and black out one or any chance of catching the conspiracy. One murder, Mary Jo Capecchi's murder, and the accident at Chappaquiddick removed the chances of a very good candidate from being president of the United States, and the other launched a big story that gave the United States its respectability and assured more budgets for defense that would go under the umbrella of the Apollo program, which did run into billions of dollars. Now, I'm going to read you parts of this book by Mr. Kasing, Bill Kasing, as much as we have time for, because I've marked practically the whole book. And I'll give you the address if you have that pencil. And I'm going to give you some of his reasoning or arguments on the space. You can write to Mr. Kasing, K-A-Y-S-I-N-G, Eden Press, E-D-E-N Press, P.O. Box 8410, Fountain Valley, California, 92708. He's making a movie in Las Vegas on this story, They Never Went to the Moon. And as a matter of fact, he had called me and suggested my being in the movie, but I would never go into Nevada for reasons which are pretty obvious. I wouldn't feel safe there. You're not necessarily safe in Carmel, but I really wouldn't feel safe going there. And I haven't heard any more about the movie, but if you want the book, write to me if you didn't get the address, and I'll see if I can get it to you and give you information about it. In the foreword, Mr. Kasing said it has been estimated that 30% of the adult population does not believe that the country landed the astronauts on the moon. While the moon swindle is gigantic, it actually takes a lesser place to such monstrous hoaxes as the $200 billion food swindle, the $300 billion tax swindle. Swindles are perpetuated by the U.S. government in areas of defense spending, drugs, medicine, price rigging, and Social Security. During the summer of 1969, he said, I had the feeling or belief that a man's journey to the moon is still in the future, and I began to pay attention to the Apollo space flights because he had worked for 10 years in the scientific field. In the introduction, he also says, apparently a substantial number of Americans do not believe that their government landed men on the moon. This is a quotation of David Weiss from the book The Politics of Lying, in addition to the statistics that 30% didn't believe it at the time. On June 14, 1970, the Knight newspaper published the astonishing story of statistics of interviews with people and asked whether they believed the astronauts had been to the moon and back. He said government deception is part of an official secrecy, and the public relations machine has reaped a harvest of mass public distrust. As the years went on, Mr. Kasing says he wrote this book in 76 and he began to doubt in 1969. I found myself comparing the Apollo flight to other incidences in American life. Watergate is an outstanding example of a comparison where the leaders presented one face in public life and the facts were hidden. We have a Machiavellian duplicity that shocks many people and shatters their complacency. The energy crisis was another Apollo simulation. An entire industry had an artificial shortage to ram the price increases down the gullible customers. He said, now it is time to ask questions of NASA. Why did Dutch newspapers in 1969 question the authenticity of the moon landing? Why did the American press ignore the other interesting sidelights of it? Why is it that NASA Apollo records are not classified anywhere, but they're also not available to the general public? Why are so many astronauts ending up as executives of large corporations? Was this their real reward for the moon trip? Why did some astronauts die in accidents, others suffer brain damage, others had nervous breakdowns? Was this the rate of attrition higher than should be expected for carefully selected and trained individuals? Did it relate to the high incidence and departure of witnesses to the Kennedy assassination? What happened to the Barron report? Thomas Barron had a 500-page report compiling the errors and mismanagement at the time that three astronauts died on Pad 34 in 1967. This was 2 years before this moonshot went up. But right after that, Mr. Barron died at a railroad crossing under mysterious circumstances in Florida, and the report is not available. Why did the relatives of the astronauts refer to the unreality of the events? Why was the fact that the astronauts were doing their training in the Las Vegas area not publicized? Every other aspect of their life was examined in close detail. And this Las Vegas issue I want to go into in regards to Howard Hughes moving into the Las Vegas area and closing off a certain area which he, in quotes, bought, and the secrecy of the Vegas operation was when the astronauts were training in Las Vegas, and Howard Hughes' organization was a front for the satellite CIA communications. Why? He says, we knew everything else they were doing. Wasn't it part of the Nevada desert, the Mercury test site, actually, of the Atomic Energy Commission that was groomed for the moon set? Why were the first astronauts held in quarantine so long after their first trip, when most scientists agree that the moon is sterile and there's no chance of disease transmission? Was it because they needed a period of reconditioning after the spurious trip, or could they not bear to face hordes of cheering people so soon after playing their role in this show on Earth? Why was Apollo 6 a total fiasco, followed by six perfect missions, which were followed by manned orbiting lab debacle? Doesn't this cause a credibility gap among the statisticians? Why was there a rigid and unbending requirement that all data for public release had to be cleared through public relations offices of NASA and nobody else? Why were all transmitters to be public via TV and radio, media of communications, easily faked? Why was there nothing to see other than the launch, which we saw, some fuzzy pictures allegedly coming from the moon? Is there any real assurance that the astronauts were aboard the Apollo? Is there any proof that they really flew a full load of fuel? And he goes into the statistics of the fuel, which are really interesting. Eight astronauts died in non-space accidents. Were they all accidents? Why did Wernher von Braun of NASA go to become a Fairchild executive? His whole life was devoted to space travel. He was obsessed with space. Did he finally realize the folly of trying to reach the moon with equipment built by the lowest bidder and the firms with the most skilled lobbyists? What did Pat Collins mean by her remark on July 20th, 1969, Houston time? This is the wife of the astronaut. When she said, it's about as real as anything about this whole thing, when she was asked if a simulation docking on scene by TV was real. And she talked about as real as anything could be. Why were the moon rocks rushed to Switzerland right after they landed? Remember, these rocks were taken immediately out of the country to another country when the scientists were here. He says, what proof do we have that they're actually rocks from the moon? Why did the landing of all Apollo return capsules take place out of sight, that nobody was able to see them land? Even the pickup carrier crews couldn't see them land. What, or get out, why was there never a mention of gold, silver, diamonds, or precious metals on the moon? Were there any metals? Why was the fact that the moon mission was a military project concealed from the public? Many military fiascos are hidden from the public because they lose prestige. Photos of the men being launched, ticker tape parades, a bag of rocks, and a few superficial items are all we have to prove that they were there. Then there's a quotation in the book here by Paul Jacobs, called America's Leading Investigative Journalist. He's a journalist, saying that Mr. Kasing may be crazy, but he may not. It said, maybe Bill Kasing is crazy, but his version of the moon program ought to be read and studied carefully, because if it's true, it explains a lot of hitherto unexplained mysteries and cover-ups. I might say now that Paul Jacobs wrote the introduction to this book in 1967. Paul Jacobs is now down to 110 pounds, I read. He's dying of cancer. I don't know whether it's a Jack Ruby cancer or a Martha Mitchell cancer, but I think it's terribly serious that we locate what doctors were seeing these particular people, or what kind of treatment, and how many people are being killed or have cancer. Mr. Barron was killed at a railroad crossing, and maybe it's coincidental. Maybe I'm becoming too paranoid, but I think it's interesting. There's two people in this book that are mentioned. One is Peter Bach up at KOME in San Jose. I can't locate him either. He did a show about this book, We Never Went to the Moon, and this author is concerned because the station won't give you any forwarding address or tell you anything about him. And I did a radio show, several shows with Victor Bach at KOME in San Jose, and I can't locate him either. And I've been to his home. The phone's disconnected. Letters aren't received. I can't reach him. I don't even know if he's alive or where he is, Victor Bach, but Bill Kaysing thinks it's something to worry about because they did a show about the Moon Project. And here's Paul Jacobs, who writes a quotation in this book, one of the few that's asked to do that, and he's dying of cancer. And the Barron Report on the fuel, the author of that, was run over at a railroad crossing. Now, in this book, he goes into, there's 10 chapters, and he goes into many subjects on the Atomic Energy Commission, the role they played, the secrecy with the atomic bombs, and how they could, after doing that, could take it into the moon, the government experience with secret operations, and a lot about the fuel and the problems of covering it up. And he has a geographical area marked off in the Las Vegas, Nevada, about 70 miles outside of Nevada, that is marked off, that he claims is the area that was kept for security, that was used for the simulation of the moonshot. He goes into government secrets in the past that were kept from us, where public officials had disclaimers. He goes into the U-2 story, the five excuses of what Gary Powers was doing in Russia, and finally the admission of President Eisenhower that it was a spy ship, and then the CIA involvement in Guatemala that was denied by Alan Dulles before Congress, and the cover-up on that that was a lie. And he goes into the CIA operating in Indonesia and interfering with Sukarno forces over there, and Alan Dulles testifying before Congress that we're not intervening, and that was a lie. And he refers to the Bay of Pigs operation, the CIA fiasco, and then he goes mentions the Kennedy assassination, how the CIA could cover the Kennedy assassination, November 22nd, 1963, and he has a good point in covering up the ability of the government to tell you one thing, looking right at you, and lying. Now, the chronology is important of the space show. For those of you that might have started listening to the show just recently, I'm referring to a book called We Never Went to the Moon, American's $30 Billion Swindle by Bill Kaysing, a book that every researcher on conspiracy should own. He says that the film 2001, the movie on the space odyssey, was considered a really documented science fiction movie concerned with space. He said it was started in the summer of 1965, at about the time when those who knew what was happening at the Apollo project had to make their final decisions. The filming took 2.5 years. The original budget was $6 million, and then they padded it with another $4.5 million, a $10.5 million budget. There were 205 special effects shots. And then he said they went into the universities, the 70 industrial and aerospace corporations, universities, observatories, weather bureaus, laboratories, institutions to ensure that the film would be technically accurate. And the Apollo space program could use the 2001 as a cover. He claims that that movie in 1968 prepared the American people for the film version of space exploration that would take place in 1969. Now, the year that this began was 1965, that 2001 started rolling and using these universities, and by 1967, the movie was in the process of being made. The space project began to be simulated in this time period also, and I think that's important when you study the chronology of Howard Hughes. He had lived in seclusion in Hollywood from 1957 to 1966, and that's the year when 2001 was being made and when the Nevada land was being sealed off, and Howard Hughes' empire, the CIA aerospace, had moved into the Las Vegas area. In 1966, the mysterious Howard Hughes had a mysterious care, surgical or otherwise, in a Boston hospital. We don't know what that was. The medical records aren't available. And then allegedly moved out to the Las Vegas area from 1966, when they left the entourage in 1970. I have maintained that there was no Howard Hughes in the Vegas area in that time at all, that that's where the double Vance Cooper was simulated and transferred. At the same time that the Hughes operation moved into Nevada, and Mr. Kaysing has the maps of Nevada, he shows the location of the astronauts in Las Vegas, and they all moved into the area. And this is kept secret from people who haven't read the book. He's got a picture of the Las Vegas Strip. And at that time, the MGM Grand Hotel was booked solid for 3 years. and you couldn't get a room at the Dunes. And he has pictures of the Dunes buffet, which would serve the astronauts. He says they have one of the world's finest buffets on the 24th floor. He shows pictures from the Vegas newspapers of the Mercury base out there, where the astronauts were swimming and had their pools. The astronauts went to the University of Nevada in Las Vegas and picked up some extra degrees while they were there. He has photographs of the desert floor, the sand dunes, and the clerks and secretaries that were used by the Apollo space program in secrecy out in this area. And the allegation is that the Los Alamos was kept quiet during the building of the atomic bombs at the end of World War II, just as they were winding down. And he claims that the Apollo space program was done in Mercury, Nevada, unknown to most people. In this book, he has a picture of a test site, the Nevada test site, that we've heard so much in relation to Howard Hughes. And the story always was that Howard Hughes wanted to stop atomic testing in Nevada, which doesn't make sense. Atomic testing was being done there, and they moved there at a time, and the test sites were built. It wouldn't make sense for this person who was totally drugged and zonked anyway and couldn't make a free opinion to worry a little bit about the test site. But it seems to me that the moon story overlaps here, and there's a bigger story about the Hughes organization and the moonshot. There's a quotation here from the Atomic Energy Commission booklet showing the Nevada test site that they used, and then it said the original site had 415,000 acres, roughly 640 square miles. But in 1956, when they were beginning to expand this, they added the desert rock area and the Pahuti Mesa, and by 1964, they increased the size 850,000 acres, or 1,350 miles. In 1964, this acreage was moved around, and that used people to move in there in 1966, and they had all this extra land in addition to the Atomic Energy Commission that he believes is where the moonshots were filmed. There's a map in his book about the site and how far it is from Las Vegas and all the secret entrances and how hard it is to get in there, and he goes into the scientific parts of the fuel propulsion and how they could simulate the recordings and the landings. And I think the allegations of the Space Odyssey in 65 being a preparation through the best scientific techniques for simulating is important, because it's in 1964 that this extra land is closed off. In 65, the Space Odyssey goes. The movie came out in 1968, and in 69, this giant hoax was started. It's his belief, Mr. Kasing, that the Defense Intelligence Agency was the front for all of this. And if you remember, it was John Kennedy who was answering Nikita Khrushchev that said, we will get to the moon, and encouraged rushing this moonshot. And John Kennedy created a special agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which went on to have a budget of 10 times more than the CIA, much larger than the CIA. And it was under the Defense Intelligence Agency and NASA that the moon financing took place. This is a fascinating book. I haven't even begun to scratch the surface. If you want to own it, it's called We Never Went to the Moon, America's $30 Billion Swindle. And this is an anniversary of the Sputnik. I thought we'd share it today. It's Eden Press, Box 8410, Fountain Valley, California, 92708. Well, my time is up. This is Dialogue Conspiracy. We may get back to the moon next week. We'll see how the news goes. But keep your eyes open and become researchers yourself, and save any articles you can and send them to me. I really appreciate it, and we'll keep in touch.